This is Looking Forward, conversations about the future of work, brought to you by MillerKnoll.
Hey, listeners. Today, we have another special episode where members of MillerKnoll's Global Research and Insights team discuss what we've taken away from recent episodes. Today, I'm joined by Katie Finlayson and Bertie Van Wyk, both of whom have roles sharing our insights with organizations around the world as we discuss episodes 4 and 5 of this season. Now, if you haven't already heard these episodes, be sure to go check them out and then join us as we consider how the insights that our guests have shared in those episodes can be applied to create better work experiences in the future. Enjoy this conversation with Katie Finlayson and Bertie Van Wyk. Hey, Katie and Bertie, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you for having us.
Great. Thank you.
I appreciate you two both being on. More so, I appreciate the chance to work with you on a daily basis. I want to make sure our listeners get to know you a little bit and what you do. So, Katie, maybe you can kick us off. Tell us about you, what you do, maybe a little bit about your background.
I head up our workplace strategy group at MillerKnoll. We really work with our clients hand in hand to help try to solve some of their problems. And I've got a facilities management and commercial real estate project management background. I've actually been a MillerKnoll customer, and I have a degree in sociology. So I'm really fascinated by why groups do what they do.
Awesome. Bertie, tell us about yourself.
Well, I share our global research for MillerKnoll, and I'm based in London. And for almost 2 decades, I've been working in the future of work and workplace. I pretty much effectively equip organizations and individuals with the knowledge and skills to become more productive, more healthy, and more connected at work. And this year, I've worked with leadership teams across the globe, including the North America, I've been in Africa, and all across Europe, and I'll be doing much more this year.
I love it. And I know you're based in London, but I should ask, that's not a British accent, is it?
Yeah, and it's not a very good South African accent either, but it is a South African accent.
Awesome. Well, for the sake of our listeners, both Katie and Bertie play critical roles in taking the research that we do and sharing it either broadly. I mean, Bertie, you're on stages around the world. I've seen you in so many countries in the last few months, or with Katie's team drilling down like really specifically with specific customers to try to apply the research to help their workplace strategies. So I'm grateful for both of you, because without you and all the people you work with, we'd be doing research, but I'm not so confident that it would get to the people that need it. Well, today we're doing another one of these cool episodes. This is our second episode where we unpack what we've heard from some of our guests and we talk about what stands out to us, but also how maybe we can apply this. We're going to focus on episodes 4 and 5 of the podcast this season, which have rich amounts of information, particularly for those that, you know, create or manage workplaces. So I'm looking forward to diving right in. Let's begin with episode 4 with Despina and Kevin. We talked a great deal about hybrid, what is or isn't working. I'm curious, of all that we talked about, what themes stood out to you? Bertie, maybe I can start with you. When you think back to it, what comes to mind?
Well, I've always been a very big fan of Despina, and I'm very interested in seeing the Cushman and Wakefield data, because she mentioned that well-being scores are globally actually down. And then she gave a few reasons for that. The first thing she said is our always-on cultures. So if you're working remotely or you're working from home, you never switch off, which you could do if, potentially if you went into an office, had a bit of a break for the commute. She says we got longer work days, so you don't create any kind of barriers. You just keep working through the day, or, you know, working parents, maybe at 8 o'clock, you start working again once the kids go to bed. Less time on focus, so you don't schedule any focus times. You're spending so much time just in meetings. And then the lack of that social connection, all of those things add up to decrease our global well-being score. But then she said something very interesting. And she said, when you have choice and you choose to come into an office, your well-being score actually increases dramatically. So having that choice, but then choosing to go into an office, is actually fantastic and really good experience to elevate our whole kind of employee experience. So I thought that was super interesting and fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. The whole well-being thing is, I think, even for those of us that have been in the industry a while, so much deeper, richer, and in some ways more complex than maybe how we've treated it in the past. I know we had a whole episode with Gethin and Andrea earlier in this season, but yeah, those scores were really interesting. Did that stand out to you too, Katie?
Yeah, you know, I feel like more of our clients are starting to finally talk about this and value this. And there's a sense, just last week, I had a kind of roundtable discussion and everybody was talking about it. I'm finding that not everybody knows what to do about it, but just the fact that we're talking about it is half the battle. And I think that things will slowly push forward. I also think that there might be some residual from the pandemic. We're not quite sure how we all came out of the pandemic. And that might be also still impacting us a little bit. I think we're still adjusting back. And I think that that's also worth considering.
It is. I think it's the burdens on all of us who work in this industry to help anybody in organizational leadership think that the physical workplace has a role here. I mean, don't get me wrong. I know that people have thought about like back injury and ergonomics, and that's super important. But this whole topic of social isolation, I was at an event recently with Malcolm Gladwell, and he was talking about younger people and some of the mental health challenges of younger people. And I don't want to directly quote him, but basically his point was, if people are feeling isolated and struggling, working by yourself from a home full time doesn't feel like a recipe for positive change. But I also was caught by what you mentioned, Birdie, in a really interesting way. Despina shared that it was choice of coming in that then led to the positive outcomes. If you force someone to come in, then apparently it wasn't beneficial. That was fascinating.
But also, if you look at the Better Up report that we quote quite a lot, is it shows that people with low social connection are 70% more likely to feel burnout than people with high social connections. So just having that ability to come in, that choice of, yes, I want to connect with others and I have the opportunity, there's a great space that's designed for me so that I can have those interactions that can actually really alleviate those elements of burnout.
One thing that I think about that I don't have the answer for, but I wonder if, you know, the employees that truly feel like they have choice, if when they come in, they're coming in a more purposeful way, and that might be part of what's making them feel more engaged and better. Because what we found is that so many employees that we talk to that need to, let's say they need to go in 3 days a week, if there is a really strong workplace strategy and a purpose for why they're coming in, they're depressed because they say, I'm sitting at my desk and I'm on Zoom calls all day doing the same exact thing that I was doing the day before at home. So I wonder if they truly have choice, they can then think about, okay, why am I coming in? Let's make that a more purposeful experience and get more done, do the kind of work that's useful when you're together, and then also get the benefits of being together as well.
Great point. Yeah, you're right. It implies that people can be more purposeful in their time in the office. And I would agree, if you come in and you're really hoping to connect with other people, which we know that's the primary goal for most, and instead you're still stuck in the same routine you were doing at home, but just in a less convenient place, that's not a super positive experience, is it?
No, and at least in workplace strategy, we find that that's happening more than we'd like it to be happening. So we really talk with a lot of our customers about the purpose. What is the purpose of your space? What is the purpose of people coming in? And if it's purposeful, they're going to be motivated to come in because there are benefits. There are very clear benefits of being together socially, in terms of well-being, but then also just in terms of the work. You can get better work done together for certain types of work. And I think we've all found that having to have work remotely.
Yeah, but you're finding that in some instances or in many instances, it's more of just like be in the office a certain number of days a week, and that's where the guidance stops, so to speak.
Yes, here are your days. And then that's kind of where it stops. And it was interesting, I listened to an episode of the podcast last season, and there was some discussion about team-based agreements, that if you really get it right at the team level, the team manager kind of meets with their people and says, okay, let's lay out what we do as a team. Okay, we whiteboard it all. All right, what things are done pretty well at home? All right, let's bucket those and put them over here. These things we all agree we can do better together. So let's be purposeful about when we're in to get those things done, because our work will be better, we'll be more successful. Maybe we can get that work done faster, be more efficient. And that fascinated me, because we're finding that that's where it really works, is not just at the C level where they're setting this workplace strategy and the personas and this is many days we want you in, but then it has to also come at the team-based agreements. And that's where sometimes we see a break.
And with that one, I think it's because you understand the why. You understand why I'm coming into the office. You understand why I'm doing this work and why I'm doing it with others. where the opposite is human resources sends an email saying policy 5.3 says you have to be in the office 3 days a week, and that's command and you have to comply, and nobody likes that at all. So yeah, absolutely, that's the right way forward.
I'm with you. And I think team level agreements are underutilized. I was talking with one of our customers in South San Francisco, a life sciences organization that's extensively used team level agreements to improve their way of working. And I'm kind of at the point personally, the more I think about this, that I don't know how many organizations will really be successful with just enterprise level policies or changes if they're a big organization. You know, if it's 125 people, maybe, but to get it to a team level and have some guideposts and guardrails around, okay, the expectations in, you know, that we're in a couple of days a week, but let's talk about how to use that time best. What can we do in terms of changing our core collaboration hours or whatever to make it work? The challenge, though, I think, is that if you're more of a black and white thinker and you're used to like sticking by the rules, to have each team leader go and engage their employees and then also try to enforce that, it's asking a lot more at a team level, but I don't personally see any other way forward for big organizations that are really trying to be more flexible in their working beyond simply instituting a hybrid policy.
I think that I have a fair amount of change management experience. And one thing that resonated in this episode was the point about there really needs to be kind of organizational change management that's done first at the ground level. And then from there, if that's done, then that workplace strategy falls into place much more easily. And sometimes we find that that's missing, but I think it's a really important piece. The why, you know, it's fundamentally, if you understand the why, if people really understand the why and you can define the why, people tend to respond really well to that.
And it's like Despina said, it's you're moving from occupancy to opportunity. So instead of going, you know, it's quiet on a Friday, measure your occupancy maybe over a month instead of just a week, because then you're worried about, oh, Friday, of course, isn't that busy. But you could have a 60 or 70% occupancy rate if you actually looked at the whole month. But it's more about the actual opportunity. It's the value that you get out of that space, not how busy is it at 4 o'clock on a Friday.
Mm-hmm. That's still a shift that's clearly underway. I have personally heard less of the this is our daily, weekly badge swipes than maybe I was hearing a year ago, but
yeah,
surely trying to embrace, okay, what's the value of the space, not just the use of the space, is something I think we're still on a journey towards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm finding that too. My team's finding that as well, that customers are referencing pre-pandemic occupancy less now, which I think it's great, because I don't believe that pre-pandemic occupancy was necessarily the best workplace experience. Just high density is not a great workplace experience. And so we are slowly starting to see that shift. It's more about purpose moving forward and people wanting to come back.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, I've said this before, and sometimes it causes maybe raised eyebrows, but personally, I don't think of the pre-pandemic office, you know, the 2019 typical office as something that was necessarily emulating like where we wanted things to go. In particular, the focus on densification, more and more small desks that seemed to be more and more stripped down, that offered less to the users, that were being used less on a daily basis than they had been 10 years previous. Like there was clearly a reset due, not that we wanted a pandemic to create it, but, and I know I'm probably overly optimistic, but I still think on some level that even if the future offices might be a little bit smaller, maybe they'll be more distributed, but they can be so much better. And if they're better, then that's a more sustainable future for the places we create, you know?
The thing that we do have to remember, and they both, Kevin and Despina, mentioned this, that most spaces aren't great. And I don't even want to use the word great. Most spaces aren't even good. So there's a lot of work that we can do to actually improve the average experience of the average employee all across the world by making small changes. And there's a few things that they mentioned too.
Totally. And by the way, shout out to BetterUp. You mentioned BetterUp. We had Dr. Christy Limegruber on the first episode of season 2 talking about social isolation and burnout. And that episode sticks in my mind a lot too, as we talk about well-being, because just this kind of increased amount of interaction we might have on video chat, et cetera, does not necessarily translate to deep connection. And I think that's what Kevin and Despina were getting after in terms of those more meaningful experiences in the office.
I think, Kevin, specifically relate the meetings to burnout, because we're just having complete scheduling inflexibility. You get your first meeting at 9 o'clock in the morning, your last meeting at 4 or 5 o'clock, and there's no time for you. There's no time for socialization. There's no time to focus. It's just a meeting upon meeting upon meeting. You know, what if we had 3 days a week where you just don't have any meetings? Or as I mentioned, what happens if you cancel all the meetings so that you just have the most important ones? Or make sure that every single meeting has a full agenda. Every single person that really needs to be there is in that meeting. Otherwise, just don't arrange another meeting. You know, be good to your colleagues. If it can be a Slack or a Teams chat, maybe just make it a quick chat rather than just another video call.
There was mention about that we are really not leveraging technology or asynchronous work as successfully as we should to make this work. And I know, Ryan, you know, you are a perfect example, and I'm trying to emulate your behavior where you just make a phone call. And sometimes what you would put your, you know, when you know it's a question, you're going to put 30 minutes on the calendar when it might take 8. But if you got the 30, you know, it via a Teams or a Zoom meeting, you're probably going to take that 30 versus maybe it was just a 5-minute phone call. And I think at the beginning, it feels a little bit uncomfortable, but it is worth kind of testing those things a little bit to see what's work and where you can free up your calendar a little bit.
I am guilty of the picking up the phone call. Bernie, not so much in the UK, because my plan doesn't cover the UK. I'm more likely to ping you on Teams. But I do, I take my dog for about a 45-minute walk every day. And I do, I make phone calls to people, many of whom who have scheduled meetings with me the following week, particularly if I don't really know what the meeting's about. And I'm just like, hey, I just want to touch base. I would estimate half the time the call results in, oh, I guess we don't need that meeting. By the way, I talked with an organization, they're a nonprofit, really cool nonprofit in Boston, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, who had decided to purposefully eliminate most reoccurring meetings. They didn't totally wipe it out. I mean, I think the press has talked a little bit about what Shopify did. They were a little more aggressive in terms of wiping out reoccurring meetings, but this particular nonprofit kind of took most of them off the calendar and then just said to their employees, it's okay to schedule them again, but I want you just to be purposeful, think about it, you know, kind of Priya Parker art of gathering sort of mindset. And they added some back in, but I just said to her, so what are the negative and positive effects? And this individual happened to be in their leadership team. She said, I don't know that there's any negative effects, but the biggest positive effect is none of us seem to feel like we're behind anymore. And I will admit that kind of cut to my, you know, I felt that deeply. Oh, yes, the meetings, they can cause you to feel so behind.
The other thing that we find that slowly it's starting to change, but a lot of organizations, they have embraced, you know, kind of a flexible hybrid schedule. They figured out the personas. It's kind of working. They haven't done that secondary piece where there's location flexibility, but there isn't schedule flexibility. Mm-hmm. So they're expected to be in their seat from 8 to 6 or 8 to 5 or 9 to whatever. And they don't have the ability to have any flexibility through the course of that day when they're home. So that's not true flexibility. And that's not true trust, where people really do feel like I can kind of manage my calendar a little bit to have the benefit of being home, which is to have a better work-life balance, maybe take my dog for a walk, go unload the dishwasher, pick up my kid from school, whatever that might be. And that's something that I think we talk to organizations a lot about, is that you have to enable to have true flexibility. Isn't just that people can work from home. It's really schedule flexibility and owning your calendar to know when you work most successfully. Some people, it's in the morning. I work better at night. So I'll do my heads down work at night and maybe take an hour during the day to run to the grocery store, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. And that's that kind of flexibility, is figuring out what works for you on those days that you're home.
For me, the kind of golden nugget that can change things overnight is a very simple change to your meetings, is just by making them 45 minutes long. 45 minutes, you have the exact same results. You know when the end is, the same kind of goals, the same ending, except you're not stressed out about your next meeting. You're prepared. You're not late for anything. You have time to get up, use the restroom if you're working from home, maybe even in the office. Just a simple change. You can start it just on your team level. You don't have to email the whole organization. Start it with just a team and see that kind of grow throughout the organization. but a simple change that has a really big impact on how good people feel every day around managing their own schedules, 45 minutes instead of an hour.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right. I feel like we should shift our attention to the Leading Towards Belonging episode with Pallavi and Mike. And I have to tell you, I know I mentioned this in the introduction of the podcast. I've known both Pallavi and Mike for years, but they didn't know each other. And they're both just spirited, super kind, like interesting people. And it was really fun for me to get kind of an odd couple together from different parts of the world, different perspectives. But I'm curious what maybe stood out to you from that episode. Maybe Katie, we can start with you.
I think the biggest thing was the topic of how we're ingrained in our work culture, and that, you know, as humans, we function as individuals and we function as a part of a group. But somehow in the work culture, the pendulum tends to swing more towards individual needs than the group need. And I don't think that that's necessarily specific to where we are now. I think that's always been the case. But I think it's important to kind of untangle that a little bit, because I do think that it's slightly more complicated now in terms of psychological safety, meeting some of those fundamental human needs. I think the landscape has gotten a little more complex with this return and kind of us all trying to figure it out.
Yeah. Bertie, what are your thoughts?
Right from the start, like right from the beginning, the statistics and the number that Pallavi had with regards to India's return to office. And by the way, I still don't like the words return to office. Who wants to return to something old? You know, maybe we
certainly
can change that.
Certainly better than return to work, though. I'm glad we never
heard that term. Yeah, it's better than return to work. What about like engaging in our flexible workplace strategy future or something like that? But moving away from that, the actual numbers of what the return to office actual rates are, when she said 60 to 80%, I think people do find it where they just generalize their own work experience and then think everyone else has the same. And I specifically see this with leadership teams all around the world, because they work in this way. They think everyone else understands that, or they work in that way. And that's just simply not how it works. But the similarities was also very interesting when you said, she said about demographics, they've got a young working group. And basically what they have is they want to socialize, they want to connect within their culture. And that echoes again with what we see in other places around the world. So do you currently have the space for you to be able to connect with others? If you're listening to this podcast right now, if you're sitting within an office environment, is there a great community space? Is there an environment where you'll meet someone from another team, where you meet someone from another department, where you can become friends, connect, learn more about the business? If you don't have a space like that, there might be a specific issue in just the environment that you're providing.
Yeah. Actually, we should at some point do an episode just on all the places around the world where office occupancy and return to office isn't really that big an issue.
Yeah.
I had the chance to connect with Nick Bloom from Stanford last week on a call that he and I had. We were focused a little bit on some of the data that they've put out through WFHresearch.com, but it's really kind of a four-country situation, Canada, UK, US, Australia, that are disproportionately having those challenges. Now, don't get me wrong, for an organization like ours, we serve a lot of customers in those places. But India, both in terms of the culture of wanting to be together and the challenges and realities of working from home, it reminds me of many other parts of the world where we don't really get into the whole return to office challenge very often because it's just not that big a deal. And it was refreshing to hear Pallavi say, no, that's not our challenge. Even places like Paris. I remember the first time I ever went to France, I had somebody say to me, you're an American, make sure you don't eat lunch from your desk while you're here, because we eat lunch together. It's like a critical part of the workday. And we saw it reflected in some of those office occupancy numbers early on. So it was refreshing just to remind ourselves that even in those countries that I just mentioned, there are cities, there are organizations that are doing great in terms of being together. But I know it's a challenge for others.
I think you made mention a few times in past conversations about how, you know, in the States, sometimes there's a lens towards it's not working. What do we do? But there are a lot of organizations that have figured this out. There are parts of the world that it's working. And even within the United States, sometimes it's by region. You know, I mean, there are a lot of success stories. There are, and I've even found it, there's a lot of clients that have kind of figured this out. They're still tweaking it. I mean, no one has a silver bullet. And I don't think that this is something where they're going to make a determination, put the stake in the ground, this is what we're doing, and never refine it or change it. It has to grow and change. But there are success stories. It's not all doom and gloom. It is working.
Well, and just to go back to your first comment, Katie, I think the fact that, yeah, maybe we've over-indexed on individual activities in the office, and maybe team and group level interactions or community interactions are so critical. That doesn't surprise me then that in a place like India, where it is, I mean, it's very communal, it's very social by and large culturally, that the office would offer a little bit different value than maybe for those of us that have historically seen it as that's the building you go to the desk that's yours to do your individual work all day long. I just talked with an organization based in the Carolinas a couple of weeks ago who, you know, that was exactly the topic, is they were like, boy, we need to shift that mindset. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the epicenter or the nucleus of the office in the future is probably teams and groups. You still need to do individual stuff, don't get me wrong. But if you're going there largely to be with other people, then we can't over-index on individual.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, there's a few things that stood out to me in the episode. The one that I loved was just the emphasis on belonging. And we talk about this as a team all the time, don't we? Inclusive design, fostering belonging. But to me, this is a global priority that is probably super squishy for a lot of people that might have like a finance or a corporate real estate background. But it was great to hear just both Mike and Pallavi talk about the priority of having everyone feel like they belong to part of a broader community when they step in the doors of a building. I think this is a topic we're going to be talking about for years.
Absolutely. And Pallavi specifically brought it or linked it to kind of team management and how she has to, or how she's already changed managing her teams to the way that she was managed so that she can be in a position where people do feel free. And any listener can ask themselves right now, can you tell your boss, you know what, I've got a different idea? Are you allowed to make a mistake? Do you have the ability to challenge back? And if you don't, that's something that you need to work on to make people feel like they're part of that team.
I also think that, you know, when you think about how much time we spend with coworkers, sometimes it's more time than we spend with family. Those relationships are important in our lives. We have to foster them the way we foster our familial or friend, outside of work friend relationship. Sometimes relationships take work, and it is important that those relationships are strong and healthy. There was mentioned in that episode about leadership, Bertie, as you mentioned, and you know, the best leaders are the ones that actually open it to the group and say, you guys are all smarter than I am on this one. So my job is to support you, not get in your way. Teach me, you know, because each one of you have strengths. That's why you're here. And as a team, we are stronger together because of that. And it goes back to that kind of individual think versus group think. And I feel like those relationships and championing people for what the special things that they bring to the table, understanding that together we're stronger because of that, is really important.
So we want to promote equitable work experiences. And from the Future Forum, we've seen that 47% of women are feeling burnout compared to only 37% of men. So we're clearly having an issue with either how we're managing spaces or how we're designing that. And there's a fantastic book, I'm not sure if any one of you have read it yet, called Invisible Women from Caroline Criado Perez, where she explains in one whole section just the impact of work on women, where women do 75% of the unpaid working hours in a day, which means if you've got caregiving responsibilities and you have your company social events straight after work, guess what? There's some women that can't participate because they have those caregiving responsibilities. Or the UK government did a research piece to show us that 10% of women going through menopause have to leave their workplace because it's not conducive to what they need to be able to go through what they're going through. There isn't rooms where I can go and hide, where there's different temperatures, where I don't have to explain to anyone that this is what I need or this is how I want to use a space. So we do a lot of things around, great things around neurodiversity. I think we also have to sometimes take a step back and go, is it equal and fair even for women within the workplaces that we design and how we manage it?
You're alluding to topics that we're going to get into here in the coming weeks because, and I know we covered this a little bit on season two. When I think inclusive design, I definitely think we should pay attention to underrepresented groups. But the more participative the design process, the more you begin to pick up on themes that don't just fit one group. I was having a conversation with someone not too long ago. I can't remember who it was at this moment, talking about this is not necessarily a furniture thing, but the use of icons and iconography on signage as opposed to words. And yes, it can help those with maybe limited visual acuity, but it also helps those that may not speak English as a first language. And just in general, like, wouldn't you prefer to see when you're heading to the washroom, like a picture of where to go versus a bunch of words? So the more we can include people in the process, the more I think some of those unique needs provide a path towards a better experience for all. One thing that comes to my mind is I think actually all of the guests in the two episodes we're talking about, but in particular, Mike and Pallavi kind of honed in on this, have personally reevaluated their own assumptions about what the office and how they work, like what they kind of grew up with, so to speak, and how those protocols worked and what made them successful. Like, they're all very open to the idea that maybe other people work differently than I do. Maybe they want to have different experiences. Maybe the role of the office is different. And that was really refreshing. Like, it really, I like to think that I have an open mind towards this, but it really forced me to think about, geez, what are my assumptions based on my own experience about the workplace? As an example, I think we have the privilege of seeing offices that are kind of amazing. Like, we have this idea of what an office can be. And I kind of mentioned this to Despina as well. I don't know. Do most people even have a sense of what an office can be, or does it always imply like rows of gray desks and 12-person conference rooms and nothing else? But that reevaluative process, I think we should all spend time doing this.
I've thought a lot about this because this is actually coming up a fair amount in our world, which actually really excites me. And I agree, it's less about designing for one particular group, whether that be neurodiverse or whatever that might be, but kind of understanding that you don't necessarily need to put the nail, you know, on one particular thing, understanding that everybody's coming into a space differently. They're going to process sound differently. They're going to process light differently. They're going to process hustle and bustle around them differently. And that's just people. That's just being human. That's the human experience. So if you kind of design understanding that everybody's going to come to the table slightly differently, and you want to try to accommodate for that understanding, you design at that baseline where you're really designing for everyone, that's where you get true equity, because you provide options for people for whatever that might be. Maybe they can focus in the cafe. Maybe they need a quiet room. Maybe they don't like sound. I mean, there's all kinds of things. And that's where I think that's true inclusivity.
Well, and you just put your finger on like the design challenge of the next era of workplace, right? Instead of a degree of uniformity spread across huge floor plates, like, what does it look like to compress a floor plate, provide the greatest amount of variety that actually get uptake, you know, that people actually use and want, without adding in new types of work settings that don't seem to fit for that group? Which is for me why piloting and prototyping makes so much sense in this era. But yeah, curating that variety in a relatively tight footprint, that is the key, isn't it, to offering greater equity?
And I think a lot of the times we also have to remember that we speak to people that still need to get just the basics right, which will also impact their sense of belonging or their ability just to be able to get their work done, which related directly to what Despina said around, you know, you need a great community space. And if you're listening to this podcast right now and wondering what is a community space, it is there a great environment where I can connect with others, where I have an opportunity to meet other people in my company, where I'm not completely isolated in my team away from everyone else? And then secondly, is there a great team area? Do I have a wonderful team space that when my team comes in together, we have all the tools that we need? We can talk to everyone. We can connect to everyone. We can work on our own. And then very importantly, that leads to all of these things, is there in my office right now a space where I can do a head down individual focus work without interruptions, without hearing someone else having a video call, without hearing someone else having a phone call out loud? Am I able to be productive? And then can I move between those three spaces? So for me, some of the basics is, you know, make sure you've got those three spaces at least before we start looking at being able to give all the additional add-ons.
Well, I'm going to jump onto the last one you mentioned. I'm going to add individual focused concentrated work without distraction and with ergonomic comfort, because I got to tell you, I feel like the world is, I need to be careful here, but maybe a little over-indexing on phone booths these days as the solution to focus work. Like, yeah, that's fine for a 30-minute meeting, but my goodness, yeah, if I'm going to go do 2 hours on a spreadsheet, give me a nice ergonomic chair and a height-adjustable table and someplace free of distraction, and I'm not sure booths are the answer.
And from our data, it shows, you know, when people are actually working from home, a lot of people are actually working from their sofas or from their beds. And in the UK, we show on the Office of National Statistics show that we've had a 30% increase in long-term sickness directly related to people working from home with lower and upper back pain. So adding ergonomic support is great. And then the other element around that is training. We need to train our people. If people are going to work in a hybrid way, in a flexible way, you need to train them what healthy work actually looks like. When they're working from home, when they're working in a team, what does their environment look like? What's the best way? Do I open a window? Is there fresh air? Do I have good lights? Do I make sure that there's no distractions? All of these things need additional training. We shouldn't just expect people to know all these things automatically when they're working from home.
That's true. I'm going to throw out a hypothesis to you too. And I'm crossing into the danger zone here too, because we have team members that are actually interior designers and environmental psychologists and people that know more about this than I do. But as it pertains to community space, I have a new hypothesis, which is coffee bars and social spaces seem to be more effective for smaller organizations that are less distributed. And for the bigger ones where you've got people all over, it seems to me like these internal event spaces, like these places where teams can roll in and do a day workshop or 3-day workshop, feel like they're just packed. But I don't know that the coffee bars are quite as useful when you've got employees spread out all over and maybe just aren't in a predictable location. Don't get me wrong, and I'm really stereotyping different sort of community spaces here, but this focus on like some sort of workshop internal event space to me just seems to be something I'm seeing everywhere for big distributed companies.
So I did some workshops, and we just helped design a pilot for an organization that is in the life sciences field. Through the pandemic, they ended up hiring everywhere globally. So they moved from a kind of more of an in-person culture to a truly remote, diverse, distributed culture. What they were struggling with was that because now they are so distributed, those teams need to meet more regularly, quarterly sometimes. And sometimes you've got 100 people coming in to meet, and they lacked that space. So they were using hotel ballrooms, and like AV was bad, food was bad, the experience was bad. And those distributed employees weren't getting any cultural experience because they were going to a hotel ballroom. So they took an entire floor that they didn't need anymore because they were so distributed, and they turned it into an event space. And it wasn't just meeting space. We helped design this. It was meeting space for lots of different types of meetings. We met with each team and learned how they meet, what they need, what tools they need, what they're doing, but also to have a community space, to have wine and cheese events, to have, you know, art events, to have yoga up there. And they took an entire floor, and that's exactly what they did. They turned it into a community space that's leveraged weekly now based on the changes that their organization had through the pandemic.
Cool. I love that idea.
I loved it.
The other element I see around that is I travel all around the world, and I'll see spaces where people have just not accounted for their actual growth. And the first thing they do is they eliminate that. They can eliminate that community space. And I'm seeing this happening everywhere at the moment. So you're just adding more benches and more work and more kind of these rows of workbenches. And that is a really bad situation to be in. So planning is important. But that community space, if you don't have it, then where do you go? People start eating at their desk, and you lose that whole kind of sense of community or the ability to just switch off for part of the day. But unfortunately, I'm seeing that happening quite a lot.
I'm going to put you on the spot for a second. Share with us some of the cities that you've traveled to share our research insights over the course of the last few months.
I've been to Serbia. I've been to Kenya. I've been to South Africa. I've been to Chicago. I'm in Scotland. I'm in Ireland. I'm in Sweden. I'm in Holland. And I think I'm also going to be in Prague in November, which is going to be fantastic because it's beautiful. I'm speaking at a conference there too. So a lot of places on the schedule. I think I'm doing 12 countries in 12 weeks too. So a lot to do at the moment.
Dude, that's amazing. And is the appetite for trying to understand future workplace strong in most of these places, or are you finding that it's a spectrum of those that are kind of content with the status quo or those that are trying to enact change?
More than ever, everybody wants to talk. Everybody wants engagements. Everybody wants conversations around this. I think it's because everyone currently, what they have isn't working. So coming out of the pandemic, we now have all those video calls, all those kind of additional noise levels. Our spaces aren't appropriate. They haven't been designed for how we're working right now. So everyone is struggling. Doesn't matter where I'm going in Nairobi, the exact same requests, the exact same demand, the exact same interest. If I'm in Cape Town, if I'm in Johannesburg, if I'm in Belgrade, everyone's eager to learn, especially our architects that are at the forefront and want to know what's the newest information, what does the latest data say, how can I improve this thing, and also how can we communicate this? Because the other key thing, what we all have to deal with, is you have to deal with a leadership team and get them to try and understand that this is where we will be moving towards, so that you're not just reading one article in one newspaper and go, okay, we're going to benchmark based just on that, and we'll design our whole space, our whole environment on that one comment or that one experience from one client. But the demand is astronomical at the moment.
That's awesome. And as you go around the world sharing all this broadly, reaching so many, Katie, I know your team is going deep with specific organizations to try to help them apply this. Are you finding the same thing, that we're essentially equipping people to have conversations with their leadership to help rethink the role of workplace more broadly?
Yes, absolutely. And it's encouraging how many organizations are wrestling with this, trying to figure out how to get it right. Not as many organizations are mandating as you would think. They really want to support their people. They want their people to want to be there. And something was mentioned in episode 4 that really resonated with me that I talk about a lot, which is we're in the middle of it. This is messy. We are experiencing a disruption real time. In 50 years, 100 years, they'll look back on this time in terms of workplace and see it as a massive disruption. And so there isn't a silver bullet. Every organization has to figure out, take the learnings, take the insights, take the data, and figure out what works for them. But it's a little messy right now. And that's okay. That's a good thing, because everyone is testing ideas and trying to figure out, once more information. What is so exciting to me to hear from Bertie is that this is a global thing. This is happening everywhere. So that really does mean that this is a true disruption. And I think we're going to come out the other side better for it, in my opinion.
I love that. Well, I'm super thankful for both of you. And for the sake of our listeners, we haven't talked a ton about the Global Research and Insights team at MillerKnoll, but as you can hear, we've got researchers, we've got folks that go and share our insights broadly across the world. We've got strategists and interior designers that specifically work to apply these insights with organizations that have unique challenges. And boy, we're all just in the process of learning with one another. I'll also put out a shameless plug that if, for the sake of our listeners, you haven't been to MillerKnoll.com and clicked on the Ideas in Action page, that's not only where you can find this podcast, but you can find monthly webinars, a whole host of other insights, white papers, et cetera. So by all means, check it out. But I will stop there and I will wrap with just a huge thank you to both of you. It's a privilege to work with you. It's a privilege to have you on the team. And I'm thankful that you gave us your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.